Hello and welcome to the Economist podcast, our usual year-ender podcast, which this year is at the start and you're almost out of the first month. This is Tariq joining you along with Jayant.
Hey guys.
So Jayant, we are ready to share what we have as a tradition here at Economist.
Yes.
Which is the list of the best books that we read throughout the year, but that's not just us telling you what are the best books that we read. We go and speak to people who are influential in the world of finance to tell us their choices, and we bring them to you. And of course, we'll also bring you our personal choices.
Yes, pretty much. We have a very interesting lineup of personalities with diverse knowledge and different book reads. So it's exciting.
Different choices. Although there is one repeat, I think we'll talk about that a little later, because the book has been that popular. So books from the world of finance, books from the world of economics, books from the worlds that straddle the two, and some other interesting books as well that our friends in the world of economics, finance, personal finance have found useful. So Jayant, why don't you get us started with your pick for 2019?
So, I mean, this book was long awaited. I mean, this is a mystery man known as World of Investing. Not many people would have heard of other than Warren Buffett. So, this is a guy known as Jim Simmons. So, this book was book is known as The Man Who Sold the Market, written by Gregory Zukerman. Again, a brilliant writer by his sheer own merit of his track record of his previous book. So basically, this book tells us about how this one mathematician straight out of Ivy College, how he was a code breaker during the US, wherein he was working for US defense when he was working as a part-time professor, and how he got fascinated with the financial markets and how he built the entire company, which is known as Renaissance Technology. And basically, Gregory lifts the lid of this most secretive firm on the Wall Street, which is not your typical Wall Street suit boot, which is not your usual thing. They are the outsiders, and these are the computer geeks who, from out of nowhere, build this beautiful big company in the world of investing. So I would like to talk about this. Basically, they use technology to take advantage of various differences which is there in the financial markets, and they started pretty early into this. So basically, this is the golden age of traditional investing, which was taking over the Wall Street for the likes of Peter Lynch, Bill Gross, George Soros, and of course Warren Buffett's of the world, wherein everyone are looking at economic data, production, profits, and intelligence, other old school style of analyzing. And here is a guy who wanted to look at things very differently. He was digging through price information and trying to see if there is any pattern through which, by coding in information, and if there is an arbitrage wherein they can just sheerly dip into it and take advantage of by investing in short-term market. The whole fascinating thing about this is how this guy, with such brilliant brains, scientists, build this firm, having different high IQ level people, and how he managed to hold them everyone in one firm, because satisfying different egos is a big problem when everyone is intelligent. And this guy held on with the sheer passion of trying to solve the market by being there. And this firm is one of the biggest survivorship bias in terms of guys who wanted to code and make money. A lot of people came and went. Nobel winners came and made money for a few years, and they blew up, and that was a very systematic risk. But here's a secretive firm which made money day in and day out of from 1988 till 2018. They have like churned out $100 billion of profit and track record of around 66% gross of fees compounded return. And this is during when traditional investing or a traditional way of analyzing or investing was taking a big time in US, and here are the guys who geeks who said that we will do it differently, we'll take a high road. The other interesting lesson is, like in, like they say in religion, there's no one way to go to heaven. The same way these guys prove that there's no one way of investing. Basically, if you experiment, if you keep experimenting, you will find the pattern, and they're sticking to pattern and keep experimenting new styles, which they have worked over the years. And this is what the big learning is, how to handle the different IQ level egos of the people. And Jim Simmons himself is a big inspiration, very secretive. Not much is written about him, but this book gave a very insight into his mind, his family, and how he built this wonderful firm on Wall Street. So The Man Who Sold the Market is my pick for 2019. So everyone, please do pick up your copy and read. And my guru Shankar Sharma also will be talking about this book in the later in the podcast. So over to you. So what is your favorite?
So like we said, there are going to be repeats, and those, that one is the repeat, but don't worry, it'll come towards the end of the podcast. My favorite pick of 2019, there were some very interesting books around, but the one that if I had to pick just one and not make it three people picking The Man Who Sold the Market,
tell me about
would be
talking about the patterns and arbitrage opportunity. Tariq actually got this book at a very less rate, so
because we got it like at a 50% discount, just because they had a sample copy out there. So
talk about finding opportunities in market,
which is exactly what Jim Simmons did. So my pick is slightly different. There were a lot of interesting books about economics in the year 2019, and mine is by a person you may have heard of, Raghuram Rajan.
Oh, sounds very familiar.
So it should be sounding quite familiar to a lot of people. So the book is called The Third Pillar: How Markets and the State Leave the Community Behind. It otherwise has gotten mixed reviews, but in my book, it is a great read. I really enjoyed reading it because it was really insightful in terms of the tension between the three pillars, as he calls it, markets, which evolved along with the modern economic system, society, which of course is as old as time effectively, but also has evolved, and both these, let's say, institutions have adjusted with each other. And then, of course, the third bit is that of community, which is slightly different from society, in his opinion, in the sense that community is more local, more specific, and more traditional, actually, in terms of it goes back thousands of years or maybe even millions of years from where we get ideas about community from, as to why we stick together, why do people sort of live together in some kinds of packs. Society is more the modern definition of the nation state and things like that he talks about. So the tension between these things have been redefined from time to time. Sometimes people have preferred to give more importance to markets. Sometimes people have given more importance to societies and communities. But the problem is that in this seesaw, communities have been left behind. So in places where the market economic system dominates, there seems to be communities which have broken down. And when economic recessions come or problems come, people cannot recover fast enough because the communities are not strong enough. And the similar issue on the other side with the socialist kind of interpretation of the economic system, where again it's the community that is neglected at the expense of a larger ideal or a nation coming together or a bigger concept. So all this, basically what it does is that during times of economic turmoil, people face quite a bit of hardship, and that hardship can become triggers for things like populism and all that we are seeing now rising around the world. So that way, it's a very illuminating read, in the sense that he, like only Raghuram Rajan can, brings out the history of how we have evolved as an economic society and the consequences of those. How did social security as an idea come up? Why did the church decide to allow usury in terms of charging interest on loans at one point of time during the medieval age? And questions like these, which kind of illuminate where we are at today. And it's a very important read for where we are at today, because, well, Jayanth, as you know, and we have spoken about, on our Economist pages and a lot of other places, that we face pretty difficult times in economics these days. So, I mean, in terms of the state of the economy.
Yeah, difficult times and interesting times.
Yeah. It's like the Chinese curse or proverb that may you live in interesting times. So these are turning out to be those. So those are our two books, The Man Who Sold the Market from Gregory Zuckerman, mine, of course, being Raghuram Rajan's The Third Pillar. But we have another six of our friends also sharing their choices. As Jayant mentioned, one of them is Shankar Sharma, and you'll be talking about The Man Who Sold the Market. For those who don't know Shankar Sharma, Jayant, what would be a quick introduction?
So, quick introduction is the most lucid man in Indian financial market, who's been around almost three, four decades, and who never shies away from speaking his mind. So
get ready.
Yeah.
Get ready for an illuminating bit from him, and of course.
So of course, we have other interesting personalities like Saurabh Mukherjee, Monica Anahab, Sweta Jain, Satish Padakana, Rauna, Amit Trivedi. So it's quite an interesting lineup of people. And
it's an interesting mix of people as well, because all these people are in different areas. Monica is a financial editor, writer.
Alignment, Hindustan Times.
With HT, he has her own book as well. Some of the other people are practitioners. Satish is very well known to us as a practitioner in the area of finance. And so are a couple of the others.
Yes.
So, take it away, and we begin with Saurabh Mukherjee from Marcellus Capital.
My name is Saurabh Mukherjee. I'm the founder and CIO of Marcellus Investment Managers. I think it's been a good year of reading for me. I managed to find lots of time to read, I think, around 25 books during the course of the year. I think the book that stood out both from a perspective of learning how to do investigative journalism and from helping me with my investments. The book that stood out was Bottle of Lies. This is a book by an American journalist about the pharmaceutical industry. But specifically, she's written about the Indian and Chinese generics industry, which makes drugs for the U.S. market. Her main source is a whistleblower in Grand Baxi, a guy called Dinesh Thakur, who's become famous, who got a $48 million settlement from the U.S. courts. The author's name is Catherine Ivan, and whilst reading the book, you could complain that there's a bit of anti-Indian sentiment in the book. She does seem to have been in a bonnet about Indian generic manufacturers. The reason I found the book useful, sentiment aside, is because I'd long failed to understand why the FDA, the U.S. regulator, has such a big problem with Indian drug companies. And if you read the book, the sorts of violations Catherine Ivan outlines, the sort of proof she puts on the table for FDA violations, actually any sensible rule violations by a whole host of Indian pharma companies, makes you realize the folly of investing in sectors where at least a non-chemist like me, non-pharmacologist like me, doesn't fully understand the issues. So if you want to understand how to drill deep into an issue, how to take apart a sector in great detail, I think Catherine Ivan's book, A Bottle of Lies, is a lot to teach us. I stress again, if you're a patriot and anti-Indianness irks you, then you'll get cheesed off by the book very quickly. But if you can set aside sentiment and put your thinking cap on, put your learning cap on, I think the book will teach you a lot about both the issues in our pharma sector in our country and about investigative techniques, how to really get under the skin of a sector and understand the issues threat there in a sector. So in a year where there were lots of good books, Safi Gokul's Loon Shorts comes to mind, Greg Zuckerman's The Man Who Solved the Market comes to mind. Year in which I read lots of good books, I think Bottle of Lies by Catherine Ivan, I'll say it was my most memorable read of 2019.
Hi, this is Monica Hallan. I'm consulting editor with me and author of Let's Talk Money. The book I have for you as my best read for 2019 is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Hariri. Now, you have to read this book in continuation of my last year's recommendation, which was Hans Rosling's Factfulness. We read them together to make us understand what is really going on with us as Homo sapiens and the world in which we live and have shaped. Hariri's book is about understanding how the rules that define the world in the post-war period have broken down. The biggest crumble has been of liberalism. Democracy has taken the world into places that post-war liberals did not dream about. And as we look for a narrative to define our story today, Hariri actually paints a very scary picture, with the digital monopolies becoming bigger than any government and out of their control. He imagines a world that is even more economically polarized than today, with a small elite being able to afford high-tech medical care. Think exoskeletons and the rest of us outside the dome. He says, quote, "Maybe in some parts of the world, you should teach your kids to write computer code, while in the others, you had better teach them to draw fast and shoot straight," unquote. The biggest favor, he says, you can do yourself is to find ways to reinvent yourself and stay relevant in this fast-changing world. One tool he finds invaluable in this crazy world, meditation. And he says, "At least for me, meditation never came into conflict with scientific research. Rather, it has been another valuable tool in the scientific toolkit, especially when trying to understand the human mind," unquote. So read, assimilate, and apply the lessons from this book.
Hello, my name is Ronak Onkar. I'm a co-fund manager and head of research at PPFAS Mutual Fund. This year has been a very interesting year for me from a reading point of view, because I went across and reread some of the books that I had learned from the past. And I said, okay, there's always a new book on the horizon and on the bookshelf, but I think it's more important to figure out what you have learned and re-emphasize some good concepts which we have. So one book stood out for me this year was a book titled The Knowledge Illusion, written by two neuroscientists, Stephen Sloman and Philip Fernbach. What is more interesting about the book is the subtitle of this book, and the subtitle reads, The Myth of Individual Thought and the Power of Collective Wisdom. The subtitle of the book is something that caught my attention, and I thought this was worth reading. To give a context, on my desk I have a pin-up message that reads, what do you really know? And this is something that I see on top of my laptop every single time I open any annual report, any report, anything I'm reading. This message, you know, is there on the peripheral vision for me. And I think this is one of the most important messages that the book drives about. So, as individuals, we rely a lot on collective knowledge, you know, sometimes even more than we think. And that's what the book tries to communicate in a knowledge illusion. Individual thought, because we get influenced by so many views around us. And this is, I think, a very relevant topic today in the whole fake news era, or even in an opinion-driven field like investing, where our opinion on a business valuation leads us to make a buy or sell decision. And I don't think this is necessarily a wrong way to think, because we need not need to know everything. Sometimes whatever we need to know should be a relevant piece of information which helps us to make that decision. So one, I think, lack of a phrase to communicate this, maybe a circle of competence or a circle of knowledge would be the right phrase to say, is really what we have to spend considerable amount of time thinking about. And this is something where we build our expertise. And everything beyond this is just a fractional knowledge. What we know about is something called hearsay or somebody else's opinion or somebody else's views or something, where if we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about something, this is clearly out of our circle of knowledge, and everything else which is said is actually a hearsay which we are building our opinions on. And this is not really informed enough to reach a meaningful conclusion. So when we combine this sort of fractional knowledge that we have from other systems, other sources, and we add our mix of behavioral biases, which are very, very hard to eliminate, we get a very potent combination of misinformation, and which leads to bad decision making. And this is what the book tries to convey in several examples, several case studies, several scientific research papers that they review, saying that a lot of knowledge that we rely on so heavily and think that we confidently know something is actually a little bit of our own competence, and a large part is dependent on the collective wisdom which we rely upon. But you know, we should not despair, because we don't know everything. The authors have a very interesting solution for this. So they recommend reading a research paper, but actually I'll just summarize it in this small audio clip, is that they introduce a concept called the illusion of interesting solution, because it really works in terms of demystifying how much we know and how much we don't know. And it gives us a rating as to what our standing is. So imagine if you have to rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 7 about how much you know about something. And this is something you do when the topic is given to you and say, okay, now rate yourself. So if you are a model somewhere in the middle, if you think you know very well about the concept, you might rate yourself closer to 7. And if you think you don't know anything about the concept, you might rate somewhere close to 1. Now the second step is far more important. It says after you rate yourself, you have to explain each and every aspect of it in as much depth as possible. And if possible, write it down on a piece of paper which will help another person to understand it. And it has to be very detailed. It has to be step by step of what that concept means to you and how you understand that concept. And once you've done that process, wait a while and then go back to the rating scale and rate yourself afresh on a scale of 1 to 7. And this really helps you know that whether you had rated yourself far more optimistically or pessimistically in the past, or how you will rate yourself after you have explained everything to on that piece of paper, and that is the realistic rating of how much you really know. And I think this concept implemented to even basic things like decision making about stocks or investing really works, because you may think you know a lot about the business just by looking at the business's name, but the moment you have to specify as to why you understand this particular business well, that's when you really know how much we know. So that's my recommendation.
Hi, this is Satish Pathakarnaya, Chief Strategist at 9010 Financial Planners. So my book for the year is 59 Seconds by Richard Wiseman. Richard Wiseman is a psychologist, and when he met his friend, she was asking him, I don't want any of these motivational stuff which takes years to get results, and we don't know whether it gets results or not. Do you have anything which can be implemented within a minute, right? It sets him thinking. Then he referred so many psychological research papers and magazines and various other books on psychology, and he came up with the various techniques which is scientifically proven where it can be implemented within 59 seconds. So the result is this book, and it is very interesting. Some of the techniques we can straight away use in our life. Say for example, if you're really angry or unhappy, how you can feel instantly happy by doing just some simple act like keeping a pencil between your teeth, right? Which is very funny, but it works, right? And if you lose your wallet, how will you increase the chances of getting it back? Just put a baby's photo, smiling baby's photo inside the wallet. This has been empirically tested. In various places, he threw wallet with various photos of the couple, the elderly person and babies and nothing in that. And he had a control group, and the chances of getting a wallet back with a baby's photo in that is very high. It has roots in our evolution, right? So similarly, be aware of the vehicles which has a bumper sticker, right? The usually that is a riskier vehicle, and don't try to follow those vehicles. And if you the chances are there that they will be violent. So similarly, one who has pet, it increases his health. That's again a scientific fact which he has given. And another important thing what he says as a financial advisor, makes sense for me also, that after a certain amount of income, then it will not increase a people's happiness, right? That means we get used to the things very quickly, then it will not increase our happiness. So there is no point in chasing happiness by increasing our income after a certain level. So as a whole, this book gives you lot of insights about various real day, everyday facts, right? I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and thanks Jayant for giving me this opportunity to talk about this.
Hi, I'm Amit. I'm an author and a trainer. I've written four books on personal finance and investing. My latest book called Invest Stories was launched in November 2019. So that makes fourth book. 2019 happened to be a low year when it comes to reading. Normally, I read around 40 to 50 books a year.
In 2019, I did around 22, so could do only half the job, which is for various reasons. But the book that is a book written by a person who is a very interesting personality. She is a doctor of psychology and a financial advisor. So she used to practice psychology and then she became a financial advisor. That way the book came up with some unique perspectives. Her name is Moira Somers and she lives in Canada. The book is Advice That Sticks, How to Give Financial Advice that People Will Follow. Very interesting book, because in my experience with this is that the best of the advice also is often not implemented. So there seems to be a gap between intention and action, or a gap between advice and action. And that's somebody recommended this book, and I read it. It's a very, very piece. It's a very well researched. It comes from two different fields in both and a financial advisor. In both the cases, advice plays a key role. So let's just look at a couple of things from the book. And first of all, when it comes to advice that sticks, the author defines the word adhering to the advice, so adherence. She says adherence will be broadly defined as the extent to which a person's actions align with agreed upon recommendation from the practitioner. Now, that strategy introduces a beautiful concept of co-creation in this approach, that there is a practitioner, an expert who advises, and somebody has to act upon that advice. So first, the advice has to be right, and second, the advice has to be executed in the right manner. So this is the beautiful part. The second aspect of this co-creation is the recommendations which are based on the advice. So those recommendations have also to be agreed upon. So both the practitioner as well as the client, okay, whether you are in the business of giving advice or not, this will be the best there. Thank you so much.
Hi folks, my name is Shweta Jain. I'm the founder of Investography. I'm a certified financial planner and an author. I've written the book called My Conversations with Money. Today, I'm going to be talking about a favorite book of mine. This is one of the books that shaped the way I spoke about money. It's called A Wealth of Common Sense. Before reading this book, so there is a before book and after book, Shweta. Why I say that is because before reading this book, I always thought to sound smart and to sound intelligent, you need to complicate things or you need to confuse people about things. But after reading this book, I figured out which is most difficult is simplicity, explaining any concept in a simple manner, in a way that your grandmother understands, or in a way that a child understands, and that's the most difficult bit. One of the reasons that this book is such a favorite of mine is because of a different style that Ben Carlson has adopted. Ben Carlson is the wonderful author of this book. I hadn't heard of him before this book. I read this book first time in 2015, 2016, and I had read this multiple times after that. So I do a lot of workshops in my line of business. I talk to people about money. Yes, I get paid to talk to people about money. And this book sort of defined my style for me. So before, when I would talk to people about money, I would be serious, because I presume that people want serious conversations about money. But after this book, I figured, hey, you know what? Money could be fun. Money could be funny. And that's one of the reasons why this book has shaped the way I talk to people about money, because Ben has given wonderful examples of how he talks about money. He talks about money in a funny way. He has, in fact, cracked a number of jokes in this book, but not to take away the part that is also a serious book. What am I looking forward to read this year? I know you should be looking forward to reading A Wealth of Common Sense by Ben Carson. Of course, you should read my book too. It's called My Conversations with Money, if you haven't read it already.
Hi guys, my name is Shankar Sharma and I head First Global, which is a global securities firm engaging various kinds of financial services. I'm here to talk about the best book that I read in 2019, and that choice is pretty clear. It is the Jim Simons, it's like the biography, not the official biography though, of Jim Simons of Renaissance Technologies, written by Gregory Zuckerman. So it's a very interesting book, and of course we've grown up hearing about Renaissance Technologies and the kind of fabulous returns they have delivered for nearly like 20 years. But you know, that's what is well known already. But I'll tell you what my learnings from this book were, and they were pretty straightforward. There is nothing called overnight success. There is nothing called a hot streak. There is nothing called that you worked hard and you necessarily succeed. It's a million different variables that go into making a business as successful as Renaissance. And the central learning there was that Jim Simons had no clue what he was doing till he was nearly 50, or at least mid-40s. He was still wandering around between academia and trading, not being particularly successful at either. And that's the fascinating part, that he just kept trying to figure out whether there was some method to the madness of the market. There were innumerable attempts he made. There were partners who came, partners who went. They basically, by even as late as the early 90s, he was managing, or the late 80s, early 90s, managing a paltry $20, $30, $50 million, which by U.S. standards, I mean, if you were to equate that in Indian context, you'd be managing like 5 lakh rupees. That's the equivalent size. So he was, for all practical purposes, a guy going nowhere fast. But he kept at it. And that, to me, was a central learning, that if you stick around long enough and you hire very good minds and brains and you keep a very central vision that you have to crack this, usually the universe will make things happen, and that's the most central thing that came out of this book for me. I think it's a must-read book for people interested in trading, not so much investing, and because I've been a trader a very long time, and a lot of the strategies that he talks about in the book, we have done and employed at various points in time. So for me, it was also a personal bit of interest in this book. And the other point is very simple, that why am I at this age reading books of this kind when I have done enough of this in the last 35 years of doing this? The point is that you will glean something from every single thing that you will read. Not necessarily just finance, but history, geography, philosophy, physics, chemistry, and general sciences, of course mathematics. The business of investing is not a narrow business where you just know a few ratios and you'll be successful. It is a very, very total business in which it brings to work the totality of your learning. So I would highly recommend this book, and I would also highly recommend that please always keep learning.
So there you go. That was the list of our favorite books of 2019. Once again, many thanks to...
So especially shout out to all the guys who are from, in no particular order, Saurabh Mukherjee of Marcellus Investment, Monica of Hindustan Times of Investography, Aman Satish Padakkanaya of 9010 Financial Planners, Rona Komkar of PPFAs, Amit Trivedi, and of course Shankar Sharma of First Global.
Right, so that was the set of luminaries telling us about their favorite books. Hopefully you will pick up some of those and let us know what you thought of them, and otherwise you'll pick up books of your own and let us know what you thought of those books. Happy reading in 2020.
Yes, have a great reading, and don't stop reading. Keep always reading.
All right.
Doesn't matter what you are reading.
Keep reading, and we'll see you with another podcast very soon.